for headlines, Russia says sending weapons and mercenaries to Ukraine by the West would cause the conflict to take a catastrophic turn, leading to a, quote, global collapse. A student dies and two others are injured in a shooting outside their high school in the state of Iowa as gun violence continues to take tolls on U.S. schools. Also, Syria calls on the United Nations and the U.N. Security Council to avoid double standards in responding to Israel's acts of aggression against the Arab country. Thank you for joining us. Russia and Ukraine trade blames over the evacuation of civilians as the conflict between the two countries is about to enter its third week. Addressing a Security Council meeting, Ukraine's UN ambassador accused Russia of violating the two countries' earlier agreement on humanitarian corridors. Sergei Kislytsia said Moscow insists that all passages for the evacuation of civilians must go through Russia and Belarus. He also accused Russia of shelling evacuees and the routes allocated for the corridors. The Russian envoy denied the accusation. Vasily Nebenzia said representatives from the Red Cross were invited to the corridors at a request of Ukraine to ensure the safety of the evacuees. Nebenzia blamed the Ukrainian nationalists for breaching the agreement on the evacuation process.
The radicals in Mariupol violated this agreement, as is clear from a radio conversation that was intercepted between two commanders of the Nationalist Battalion Azov, that is in Volnovakhi. The radicals there were told to shoot at the legs of those who were heading for the humanitarian corridors. Those who risked life and limb to try and leave Mariupol, when they reached the checkpoints to exit the city, were shot on site by Ukrainian Nazis. There's a great deal of video evidence of this.
In Mariupol alone,
the Russian envoy accused Ukrainian nationalists of using civilians as human shields. He said they hold thousands of civilians, including foreigners, hostage. Nebenzia also suggested Russia will open humanitarian corridors on Tuesday to allow civilians to leave Ukraine towards Russian territory. Meanwhile, the UN aid chief has called on all parties to allow safe passage for civilians in Ukraine to leave areas of active hostilities in the direction they choose. According to the UN, more than 1.7 million Ukrainians have crossed into Central Europe. The United Nations has also confirmed the deaths of around 400 civilians in Ukraine since the beginning of Russia's military operation there. Scott Bennett, a former U.S. Army officer, says right-wing militias are to blame for the failure of plans to evacuate citizens from war zones.
Right-wing militias and these Nazi elements that are now running to the cities to gain cover and exploiting the civilians and using them as human shields is an indication of the desperation of Zelensky's forces, and also a revelation of the darkest impulses behind the true nature of their regime, their character. They're not at all interested in the benefit of the Ukrainian people. They're not at all interested in the preservation of Ukrainian culture. They're about war and doing the bidding of their puppet masters, which is primarily the United States. So they've been pushed into this, resist at all costs, cause maximum damage, sabotage your own nuclear fields, blame it on the Russians, set off your own power outages, destroy your own water sources, and blame it on the Russians in a massive propaganda war. But I think the Russians are doing the opposite. They're winning the hearts and minds of the local people by providing safety, providing corridors for humanitarian aid, providing exit points for those who want to get out of the way. And Russia is going to focus on the annihilation of the right-wing Nazi militia groups. And I think this will be all over in a matter of days.
Russia's military offensive against Ukraine and the ensuing Western sanctions are wreaking a havoc on global markets and economy, with Moscow warning of unpredictable and catastrophic consequences. Deputy Prime Minister Alexander Novak said crude prices could surge to over $300 per barrel if the U.S. and European Union ban imports of oil from Russia. Oil prices have already spiked close to $140 per barrel, the highest since the 2008 financial crisis. On the Nord Stream 2 sanctions, Novak warned that Russia could cut gas supplies via the Nord Stream 1 pipeline to Germany, but it has not made such a decision yet. Western sanctions on Moscow, coupled with logistics turmoil, have also shaken markets for other commodities. U.S. wheat futures rose more than 7%, nearing an all-time high amid fears of supply chaos. European wheat has already hit record highs. Russia is the world's biggest wheat exporter. Together with Ukraine, it accounts for about 29% of global wheat exports. In stock markets, European shares fell to their lowest in a year, with Germany and Italy's benchmark index slipping into a so-called bear market. Pakistan has resisted the pressure of the West, particularly the European countries, to condemn Russia over its attack on Ukraine. Islamabad also reacted sharply to the unusual move by the Western diplomatic missions using social media platforms to put pressure on Pakistan. Kamar Yusuf has the details.
Joint statement by the diplomatic missions of the Western countries in Islamabad has created an uproar in Pakistan. The statement posted on the social media platforms presses Pakistan to condemn Russia. The statement was signed by the envoys of European countries and endorsed by the U.S. Embassy in Islamabad. The move by the Western diplomatic missions here has drawn strong reaction from the Pakistani government. The Foreign Office has summoned the envoys of the Western countries to tell them that issuing public statements against the host country is not in line with the diplomatic protocols. On Sunday, Prime Minister Imran Khan doubled down on the European ambassadors and made it clear that Pakistan is not their slave.
I want to ask the European ambassadors, did you write such a letter to India? What do you think of us? Are we your slaves? That whatever you say, we will do.
Pakistan has maintained a fine balance in the ongoing conflict between Russia and the West over Ukraine. The reason Pakistan refused to condemn Russia stems from its growing ties with Moscow.
The only thing that I can say from Pakistan's government perspective that Pakistan wants de-escalation. Honestly, Pakistan wants end of the war or end of bombing or end of aggression anywhere for that matter in the world.
Pakistan has remained in the Western camp for decades, but now wants to diversify its foreign policy options. It was because of this reason that despite pressure from the West, Pakistan abstained from the voting on a resolution against Russia at the UN General Assembly session. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian says his country opposes both war and sanctions. He made the remarks in a phone conversation with his Russian counterpart Sergei Lavrov, which touched upon the conflict in Ukraine. Amir Abdollahian said Tehran's cooperation with any country, including Russia, should not be affected by sanctions. For his part, Lavrov slammed the sanctions imposed on his country and stressed the need for closer cooperation between Moscow and Tehran. Separately, Amir Abdollahian had a phone call with his Turkish counterpart. He told Mevlut Çavuşoğlu that Tehran supports efforts to find a political solution for the Ukraine conflict and stands ready to lend a helping hand. Çavuşoğlu said he will participate in a joint meeting with his Russian and Ukrainian counterparts to facilitate a ceasefire. He said it's highly important to try to ease tensions in Ukraine as the conflict could lead to a humanitarian catastrophe. Iran's Al Alam Arabic News Network says Facebook has shut down its page in a quote, clear violation of freedom of the press. Al Alam says its Facebook page, which had some 6 million followers, was shut down without prior notice on Sunday. It says the American company had earlier imposed strict limitations on how the news network could publish its stories. Facebook had suspended Al Alam's account temporarily over the past years for publishing pictures of Lebanese, Palestinian, and Yemeni resistance movements and covering the U.S. assassination of Iranian General Qasem Soleimani. Over the past years, Facebook has also occasionally suspended Press TV news, including after it covered post-election violence in the U.S. in January 2021. One teenager is killed and two others critically injured in a shooting outside a high school in the U.S. state of Iowa. The incident happened in the state capital, Des Moines, shortly before 3 p.m. local time. A police statement says the gunfire appears to have come from a passing vehicle. Three potential suspects have been detained, but no charges have been filed. Mass killings involving firearms are common in the U.S., with the number of victims on the rise. Over 80 mass shootings have already been recorded this year, with the total number of gun violence deaths standing at nearly 8,000. The majority of Americans favor greater gun controls. However, lax laws and the right to bear arms have hampered efforts to clamp down on the number of weapons in circulation. Now, to discuss that story further, we have Robert Fantina, an author and journalist, on the line from Kitchener, Ontario. Robert, thank you for joining us. Welcome. A lot of people are just losing their lives easily. Children who go to school, and they're in great jeopardy. Their lives are at risk. And still, although people, a great majority of people, want stricter gun controls, nobody's doing anything about it. Why is this happening in the U.S.?
This is a long and sad story. This recent shooting, it's tragic, as they all are. And we will soon hear the elected officials offering their thoughts and prayers to the victims. Thoughts and prayers are not enough. They need to legislate to get the guns out of the hands of so many people. Now, the U.S. Supreme Court always says that, or has stated repeatedly, that the right to bear arms trumps everything else. They forget that the right to bear arms was written into law when the U.S. had a standing militia. It didn't have a regular army as it has today. But the National Rifle Association, which is the biggest pro-gun lobby in the United States, has been very powerful for years. That power is diminishing now, but it has been very powerful for years, and has invoked a thought in people's minds that owning guns is important and is necessary, and that any attempt to restrict gun ownership at all is a major infringement on their rights. This is simply not true. It's a myth, but many people have come to believe it, and that's why we have the problems that the United States has today.
Is that really it? Because I'm guessing now that somebody should be benefiting from this. Otherwise, lawmakers would have done something about it previously to this.
That's a very good point. You always, in any situation, such criminal activities as, we must look at who is making money. The National Rifle Association, that I mentioned earlier, contributes huge amounts of money to candidates running for election and re-election. They overwhelm the competition. Anyone who speaks against wide open gun ownership, anyone who supports any kind of gun control, the National Rifle Association is very generous to those who resist any kind of gun control. So it doesn't matter what the constituents say. Studies have shown in the United States that what the voters want has very little impact on legislation that gets passed. It's what the lobby groups want. The powerful interests and the pro-gun lobby is a very powerful one. So it is a matter of money, not just culture, but money. There are other countries that have lots of guns. Canada, for example, has many guns. There are lots of hunters in Canada, but they don't have the same kind of gun violence because it isn't fostered. Gun violence, the glorification of gun violence is not fostered in other countries as it is in the United States. But again, just to reiterate, people who are benefiting financially from this will not change it.
One last thing, I don't get it. Are those pro-gun lobbyists really not concerned about their own children?
They're in a position where they can, their children can be in, at least the leaders of the movement, can put their children in private schools, can have bodyguards for them, and so on. The people who they convince that any sort of gun control is an infringement on their rights don't look beyond that. We've seen, as you mentioned earlier, children in elementary schools and kindergartens being gunned down by gun violence, and yet nothing changes. There needs to be a change in the entire thought process of the American citizenry regarding guns. And there needs to be recognition that they're only used for killing people. They aren't necessary for national security. For most of the population, they aren't necessary for personal protection. They're simply a high risk of extreme violence and death.
Robert, many thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Robert Fantina, an author and journalist, joining us from Kitchener, Ontario. Moving on, Syria says the latest Israeli act of aggression and Daesh terrorist attack coming in quick succession illustrates clear and direct coordination between the two entities. The Syrian Foreign Ministry warned about the repercussions of Israel's repeated attacks. It said the raids inflict heavy material and human losses besides causing fear among the civilian population, especially women and children. The ministry called on the United Nations and the UN Security Council to fulfill their responsibility and avoid double standards in responding to such quote, seriously risky actions. Israel's Monday airstrikes near the Syrian capital Damascus killed two civilians. A day earlier, over a dozen Syrian army forces were killed in a Daesh terrorist attack in the central province of Homs. Israeli forces killed another Palestinian in the occupied West Bank city of Al-Quds, bringing to three the number of Palestinians killed since Sunday. According to Palestinian sources, the regime's forces fatally shot the man after he wounded two Israeli soldiers in a knife attack. The incident comes a day after two separate killings of Palestinian teenagers in Al-Quds. A 16-year-old boy was killed in the city or in the old city area after he, according to the Israeli military, threw a firebomb at an army post. Another Palestinian teen was gunned down the same day over a stabbing attack that left one Israeli officer injured. Tensions are running high in the occupied territories over Israel's brutal crackdown on Palestinians, venting anger at the regime's atrocious policies. And that does it for this edition of World News.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Former U.S. President Donald Trump said he would join crowd to U.S. Capitol, but his schedule indicates he deliberately lied to his supporters. We present you an article written by Hugo Lowell. The piece is titled, Trump's Private Schedule Reveals New Plans for Him to Join 6th of January March. According to Donald Trump's White House private schedule from 6th of January 2021, he was aware long before he took the stage at the Save America rally on that day that he would not march to the Capitol to protest the congressional certification of Joe Biden's election win. The former president started his nearly 75-minute long speech at the Ellipse by claiming he would go with the crowd to the Capitol, and then repeated that promise when he said he would walk with them down Pennsylvania Avenue towards the Capitol building. but Donald Trump's private schedule, released by the House Select Committee investigating the Capitol attack, in a filing on Wednesday, 2nd of March, shows that Donald Trump must have known that there were no plans for him to join such a march, and that he was being taken back to the White House. The newly released private schedule indicates Donald Trump deliberately lied to his supporters, raising the specter that he made a promise he had no intention of honoring, so that they would descend on the Capitol and disrupt Congress from certifying Joe Biden as president. It is a significant revelation that could bolster the House Select Committee's claim in the filing that Donald Trump engaged in a criminal conspiracy to defraud the United States by seeking to obstruct a lawful function of the government by deceitful or dishonest means. Ryan Goodman, a former special counsel at the Department of Defense, said, "Trump telling the crowd that he would join them at the Capitol was incendiary in that they thought that their field marshal would be there." Ryan Goodman added, "It is further evidence that Donald Trump knew he was inciting an already highly volatile situation." Former president's private schedule may also support a parallel civil lawsuit brought by the Democratic Congressman Eric Swalwell, a former House impeachment manager, that Donald Trump prompted the Capitol attack through his comments in his speech. The lawsuit said Trump directly incited the violence at the Capitol that followed and then watched approvingly as the building was overrun, adding, "The horrific events of 6th of January 2021 were a direct and foreseeable consequence of the defendant's unlawful actions." Donald Trump's private schedule for that day indicated the former president was to travel directly from the White House to the Ellipse, speak at the Save America rally there, and then immediately return to the White House once his speech had concluded. The former president was running late on 6th of January, but the timestamp on the document reads 11:22 a.m. local time, roughly half an hour before he started to speak at the rally at 11:50 a.m. local time, meaning he must have known before he took to the stage that he was not going on to the Capitol. Donald Trump's promises are significant as they served as one of the primary motivations for his supporters to march to the Capitol alongside militia groups like the Oath Keepers, and were used by far-right activists like Alex Jones to encourage the crowd along the route. Indeed, testimony in federal prosecutions of rioters charged in connection to the Capitol attack suggests that Donald Trump's promises that he would walk with them to the Capitol was the proximate cause for them to also walk up to Congress before the march descended into a riot. An analysis of cell phone data published by the New York Times also reveals that many of Donald Trump's supporters who marched from the rally to the Capitol went down Pennsylvania Avenue, just as he has suggested, a more circuitous route than walking up the National Mall. According to a source familiar with the matter, crucially, Donald Trump made the false promises that led the crowd to go to the Capitol in spite of being told by the Secret Service days before the situation was too volatile for them to guarantee his security if he joined them. That raises the prospect that the former president encouraged his supporters to march to the Capitol on a promise he knew to be false, in the hope that the security situation he had been told was volatile would lead to some event that would stop Joe Biden's certification. But regardless of what he agreed with the Secret Service, his private schedule from just before the speech indicates that Donald Trump deliberately and repeatedly lied to the crowd about his intentions in a way that could leave him vulnerable to civil charges or even criminal charges. The former president's private schedule came as part of court filings submitted by the Select Committee seeking to challenge former Trump lawyer John Eastman's claim that thousands of emails demanded by the panel are protected by attorney-client privilege. The House Select Committee said in its filing that it believed the privilege asserted over the records were not applicable because of the so-called crime fraud exception, arguing Eastman was involved in potentially illegal efforts by Donald Trump to overturn the 2020 presidential election. Furthermore, the House Select Committee investigating the 6th of January Capitol attack has subpoenaed Kimberly Guilfoyle, the fiancée of Donald Trump's eldest son. House investigators issued the subpoena on Thursday, 3rd of March, after she had abruptly ended a voluntary interview with a panel recently. The chairman of the House Select Committee, Benny Thompson, said in the subpoena letter to Kimberly Guilfoyle that the panel was compelling her testimony because of her proximity to the former president, and the rally that preceded the Capitol attack on 6th of January 2021. Benny Thompson said the panel had been left with no choice but to force her cooperation. Benny Thompson said, "Because Ms. Guilfoyle backed out of her original commitment to provide a voluntary interview, we are issuing today's subpoena that will compel her to testify. We expect her to comply with the law and cooperate." Kimberly Guilfoyle met virtually with the panel for an interview recently, but cut off questioning when she learned that the Select Committee members Adam Schiff and Jamie Raskin, in addition to counsel, had joined the call. According to a source familiar with the interview, after news of her appearance was leaked to news outlets, Guilfoyle refused to continue, and her lawyer accused the Select Committee of trying to sandbag her and not keeping participants limited to committee counsel. Members of the House Select Committee are actively involved in the investigation and are almost always present at depositions. But Kimberly Guilfoyle's lawyer said in a statement that the panel sought to use her cooperation as a political weapon against Donald Trump. Joseph Tacopina, Kimberly Guilfoyle's lawyer, said in a statement that after she halted her interview, Ms. Guilfoyle, under threat of subpoena, agreed to meet exclusively with counsel for the Select Committee in a good-faith effort to provide true and relevant evidence. Referring to the two congressmen, Adam Schiff and Jamie Raskin, Joseph Tacopina said, "However, upon Ms. Guilfoyle's attendance, the committee revealed its untrustworthiness, as members notorious for leaking information appeared." The lawyer for Kimberly Guilfoyle added that after he asked for a break to address the issue with House investigators, the Select Committee leaked a breakdown in proceedings to reporters. A spokesman for the Select Committee has denied Joseph Tacopina's claim. The House Select Committee did not address those complaints on Thursday, 3rd of March, but the subpoena authorization suggested the panel does not believe the matter precludes her from testifying about her contacts with Donald Trump and rally organizers on 6th of January. The panel additionally noted that it had earlier informed her legal team that members would be present in her interview and even offered to reschedule Kimberly Guilfoyle's interview, but she declined. The subpoena said Guilfoyle was notably present for an Oval Office meeting that morning when Donald Trump pressed the then-Vice President Mike Pence to reject slates of electors for Joe Biden at the joint session of Congress and thus return him to power. House investigators added in the subpoena that they were also interested in Kimberly Guilfoyle's claim that she helped fund the Save America rally that preceded the Capitol attack, as well as discussions with Donald Trump about who spoke at the rally. The panel said Guilfoyle told at least one rally organizer that she had raised so much money for this, literally one of my donors, Julie, at $3 million, a reference to Julie Fancelli, who did in fact finance the event.
Food for thought.
Salam, everybody, and heartiest felicitations to you all. Today is the 4th of Sha'ban, the auspicious birthday of the immortal standard bearer of Karbala, Hazrat Abbas, peace upon him. Here is what his father, the commander of the faithful, Imam Ali, peace upon him, said, entrusting the newborn to the care of the immortal martyr of Karbala. O Hussein, I am entrusting to you this child. He will represent me on the day of your supreme sacrifice and lay down his life in defending you and your dear ones, much as I would have done if alive on that day.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان اللعين الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرجهم. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We are looking at justice from the perspective of Amir al-Mu'mineen. And justice is a key element of humans and human rights. And justice itself is made up of different factors. One of the main factors we want to discuss is freedom. Freedom itself is necessary for any society. It is necessary for any system. It is necessary to establish justice itself. The method adopted by the commander of the faithful, alayhi salam, Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali ibn Abi Talib, in the matter of politics, rulership, and administration of the state, was based on the principle of the freedom of people. We can see that from the beginning, from day one, when he was elected as the Khalif, as the ruler, he said, I don't want to be a ruler. If you want to choose me as a ruler and a leader, it has to be chosen by the people, all the people, voluntary. It can't be just some people want me and the rest don't. When you guys make up your mind and all of you decide to choose me as your leader, then I will come. That is an important principle applied by Amir al-Mu'mineen. Never have we seen a personality refuses power when it's given to him. And mind you, it wasn't just a simple city that he has to lead. He was leading the Muslim Ummah, the Muslim nation, a very lofty position that a lot of people fought for to gain. We have the lack of Muawiyah, the lack of Talha, the lack of Zubair, because the Muslim world back then was expanding. It expanded all the way to Spain and all the way to China. So it was almost half of the world, if not more, of the known world that we have today. To be a leader of such great country or a city or a system or what have you, it was lofty. It used to make people kill for it. Amir al-Mu'mineen was handed to him and he rejected. He said, the point of me being a leader is that I need to serve the people, right? But people have to choose for themselves. That's a principle he brought forward, that freedom is for the people. Freedom is by the people, and freedom is, obviously, it goes back to them, not to me. And he had an ardent belief in this freedom, which can be observed in all the actions of Amir al-Mu'mineen. When a person takes Amir al-Mu'mineen and dissects his life, he can see that this principle was applied to every action of Amir al-Mu'mineen. Whether he said something, whether he gave orders or prohibited some actions, whether it was a time of war, whether it was a time of peace, or made an appointment of a governor, or whatever manner he treated people or his children, or even in worshipping Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. His conduct was based on all these occasions on freedom itself. Even in his own worship, it has to be done based on the fact that he's free and he wants to do it, not because he has to do it. Let us take a short break and we will continue right after.
Dear listeners, you're listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We are looking at justice and freedom that stems from justice itself. We said that Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, he had a very simple yet powerful principle that freedom is for the people and people should and shall be free. The question, however, arises as to why the people should be free. Why did Amir al-Mu'mineen emphasize on freedom of the individuals? Why should they be free? And why they should work according to their will and determination? Now, the answer might be simple and you might give an answer yourself, but reality is against that. If you take this question and try to dissect it and see why is it important? From where did they get the freedom? And what are its limits? According to Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, according to Ali, the real cause of this freedom is a human society which must proceed on the path of blessedness and prosperity. So this freedom that he believes in so strongly that he wants to apply, giving people their own free will and determination, it is only because with such freedom, society can proceed. Society can move on the path of righteousness, on the path of happiness, on the path of prosperity. When people's right is taken away from them, when people have no right to choose, when people have no will, when people have no determination to do things of their own, then that definitely will bring society back and bring society down to its knees and push it back to the dark ages. And we can see that even in our modern times, when you see systems and countries and governments who are oppressive, these countries and these systems are very backwards. Where if you look at systems where people have at least some of their rights and have the right to speak, have the right to elect, have the right to do things their own, you see them prosper and move forward. So Amir al-Mu'mineen's vision of trying to give people complete and absolute freedom, obviously with the limitation that people need to know their limits when it comes to freedom, he was looking at society as a whole. He was looking at the ummah and the nation as a whole. He was looking for the betterment of that nation. He was looking for the improvement of that nation. And he says it will not improve unless people have their freedom. Now, the topic and the concept of freedom in Amir al-Mu'mineen's government is a lengthy one. So, inshallah, we'll leave it up to here. And we will continue this discussion and why it is so important that Amir al-Mu'mineen focus on freedom in episodes to come. Until then, stay with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Allahumma salli ala
محمد وآله اللهم صل على محمد وآله اللهم صل على محمد وآله اللهم صل على محمد وآله
Cultural news, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With the light.
A zoo in Peru's capital city, Lima, is celebrating a rare hatching of endangered baby crocodiles. The Huachipa Zoo showcased three females and one male to the public on the World Wildlife Day. The four crocodiles were born in incubators as part of the conservation efforts for the reptile. This species is an American crocodile, which is on the endangered list of animals in Peru. Zookeepers say the black market and threats on their habitat have seen the crocodile population dwindle. The zoo regularly receives animals that were rescued from trafficking. Among those traits are tortoises, macaws, and monkeys.
The 2022 World Cup is reaching a fever pitch as hundreds of people line up at a shopping center in Qatar to take a picture with a trophy. The famous Golden World Cup trophy was unveiled during a ceremony at a mall in Doha, where excited football fans waited for their turn to see it. They were also given the option to take a selfie or have their photo taken professionally. While the competition is still nearly a year away, FIFA says more than a million tickets were requested within the first 24 hours after sales opened. The highest demand came from fans from Qatar, followed by Argentina, Mexico, and United States, among others. Bangladesh is reviving the ancient tradition of producing a historically renowned fine hand-woven fabric called muslin. With the help of the government, the trade is making a comeback. Now, a workshop has been set up in Dhaka, where weavers are being trained in the ancient art. They say it took them months to master the craft, working with incredibly fine hand-spun cotton yarns. The weavers say it takes them 8 hours to spin just 4 centimeters. Some varieties of the fabric are so fine that an entire muslin sari could fit inside a single matchbox.
There was a myth about muslin that it was so delicate that it would pass through even a small ring. Look, it's true. There is space to squeeze in another piece of cloth through this ring as well.
Breathing life back into this ancient trade was not easy. Officials with a revival project say there was little knowledge about how this fabric was made. Plus, the rare cotton variant, which makes this fabric so expensive, was also lost. The precious fabric was the most extravagant of its era and popular in Mughal courts. It was also imported into Europe for much of the 17th century and transformed the style of the aristocracy there.
An art gallery in London, Tate Modern, is hosting an exhibition with a remarkable span of surrealist works. The exhibition, dubbed Surrealism Beyond Borders, features more than 170 artworks ranging from paintings and sculptures to photography and films. Works by more than 150 artists from over 60 years are on the display. The exhibit also has a wide geographical span and includes surrealist art artworks from different countries. Some of the most prominent artists whose works are being exhibited include Pablo Picasso, Salvador Dali, and Ted Jones. The exhibition will run until August 9th. Impressive, creative, wonderful. That's how visitors describe the works of Vincent Hoch, a Dutch post-impressionist painter being displayed in an impressive art exhibition in the Argentine capital. Hundreds of Van Gogh's paintings are projected onto the walls of the gallery. The image bloom and ripple in front of the audience, creating a 3D-like and immersive experience. Van Gogh was one of the most famous and influential figures in Western art history of the 19th century. He is largely remembered for his impressionist style, a break from the old traditional art technique. He is also famous for his turbulent life, which was made for outlandish, emotionally charged paintings.
Persian language takes center stage in a conference in Tehran dubbed Promotion of Persian Language on Global Scale. The event seeks to preserve the ancient language through teaching it to non-Iranians. Yusuf Jalali has more.
Persian language has been spoken for three millennia, but like every cultural heritage, it needs to be preserved. This is according to officials from Iran's Ministry of Foreign Affairs, who sat with Persian language activists to discuss ways to promote Persian through teaching it to non-Iranians.
Today is actually the Persian language day for me and for many of my colleagues. So if you allow me, I would like to continue in Farsi.
Thank you for this opportunity. The identity of a nation is a set of shared beliefs, shared culture and history, and all of these issues are reflected in the language that each nation speaks. So today, all of those who have a role in the promotion of Persian language gathered to exchange views on the preservation of Persian, and we at the Foreign Ministry will facilitate any effort made in this regard.
A thousand years ago, Iran had a poet named Ferdowsi whose poems are still popular and understood by our generation. This is significant and shows that Persian is an old language that has stayed intact through the centuries.
Sa'di Foundation is the leading entity in the promotion of Persian language. Every year, the Institute, together with the Islamic Culture and Relations Organization, holds a number of Persian refresher courses in and outside Iran for non-Persian speakers. Recently, the Institute has launched online courses and published self-study books for Persian language enthusiasts.
By launching the online Persian training platforms, we saw a sudden increase in the number of applicants from different countries. This is because many of those who are interested in learning Persian gained an instant access to Persian teaching contents. At the same time, we continue to launch in-person courses organized by Iran's cultural attaches and hosted by Iranian overseas schools.
Persian comes from the Indo-European family of languages. The earliest versions of Persian date back to roughly 2,500 years ago, during the Achaemenid dynasty. Today, it is spoken by more than 300 million people in the world, and different dialects, including Dari and Pashto, in countries such as Iran, Afghanistan, and Tajikistan. Besides its significant impact on science, medicine, and astronomy, Persian has its own prominent place in literature and poetry. Khayyam, Rumi, Sa'di, and Hafez are only a few examples of world-renowned Persian poets. Language is the identity of a nation, and through the centuries of its spoken and written history, Persian has grown to become the narrator of Iran's rich past and its ancient civilization. Now, as learning a language is learning a culture, experts here say promoting Persian on a global scale is translated into introducing Iran and its culture to the world. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
It is now well-established facts that animals feel think, behave, and even experience pain. Thus, they should be treated with the same respect as humans, while a center in the Eastern Democratic Republic of the Congo is doing the same, life-saving services to injured apes. The sanctuary, located in a vast national park, has been active for 2 decades. The center houses scores of chimpanzees, gorillas, and endangered great apes, bonobos, and bonobos as well. Most of the animals that are brought to the sanctuary were rescued from poachers. The staff there provide medical care to the injured animals until they are healthy enough to be integrated into a group of their fellow species.
Students and staff gather for sizzling meat sandwiches as they signal their orders with their hands at a food truck in Pakistan's capital city of Islamabad. The Abbey Cow is no ordinary food truck parked on the campus of the Millennium Universal College. It's fully managed and run by staff with hearing impairments. At the beginning of the queue, a diagram shows simple phrases in sign language which customers use to order their food and communicate. The food truck is Pakistan's first mobile restaurant entirely staffed by deaf workers, providing an economic opportunity for them.
Having the startup here at our campus has been really fruitful. Not only have we created more awareness around the sign language amongst our students, but we've also created an inspiration for TMUC students to look up and pursue entrepreneurship as a career choice.
The project developer, Aisha Raza, says the majority of deaf youth end up unemployed and face inequality and discrimination. She says she wanted to create an opportunity for her brothers to economically thrive. The goal is to bridge communication gaps between the deaf and hearing communities and help remove language barriers. The food truck is the brainchild of a family where both parents and their sons are either totally or partially deaf. The 16th Fajr International Poetry Festival has wrapped up with an award ceremony in Tehran. The literary event aims to honor Persian poets from Iran and the world with the ultimate goal of elevating Persian poetry. Yusuf Jalali has more.
It's an occasion to honor poets and poetry. The 16th edition of Fajr International Poetry Festival saw its closing ceremony in Tehran, where the best Persian poetry works of the year were acknowledged and awarded. During the event, participants from Iran and other countries contended in different categories, including classic poetry, modern poetry, and children and young adults.
I won the prize for the best poetry book for children and young adults. My book is titled Silence in the Mother Tongue. I'm so glad that my effort is seen, judged, and acknowledged by top Iranian literary personalities from the jury of the festival.
Certainly, Fajr Poetry Festival is of great significance to me as an Afghan poet. Here, literary experts from Iran, Tajikistan, Afghanistan, and many parts of the world can network and make joint efforts to promote the Persian language.
Iran is known as the land of poets, being home to many world-renowned literary figures over the centuries, including Rumi, Hafez, and Khayyam. Experts here believe Persian poetry has no expiry date, and not only do Iranians still read ancient poems, they're also interested in modern prose and poetry.
Poetry is a beautiful language that speaks the beauty of the world, and such a language always communicates very well with the hearts of human beings. Iranians have long understood the beauty of this language and still listen to it.